bienvenidas a Flaxo Eventos. Mi nombre es Carlos Flores. En Flaxo Sede Ecuador tuvimos la visita del profesor Sidney Tarrow, destacado académico de renombre mundial, quien ofreció en Flaxo una serie de conferencias sobre movimientos sociales y acción colectiva. Cabe mencionar que Sidney Tarrow es doctor en ciencia política por la Universidad de Berkeley y profesor emérito de gobierno en la Universidad de Cornell. Tarrow se ha dedicado durante más de 4 décadas a estudiar los movimientos sociales. En esta oportunidad vamos a escuchar la conferencia Workers and Citizens Explorations in the Language of Contention. Escuchemos entonces al profesor Sidney Tarrow, quien disertó en inglés.
Thank you so much for this much too generous introduction. Thank you. And I would like to also thank Director Juan Ponce for this kind welcome. I would like to thank you as head of the Department of Political Studies, Felipe Burbano, for your warm introduction, and I would especially like to thank Associate Professor Cornelia Rogaband, as she is known here, we call her Connie, for making it possible for me to come and speak to the most important Flaxo in Latin America. I am so pleased to be here. I might even say, if you will forgive my Italian, sono emozionato. Do you say that in Spanish?
Yes. Estoy muy emocionado.
It is a wonderful experience for me, and I thank you very much for this opportunity. This is a cycle of lectures that is a little different than the usual cycle of lectures, in that I will be speaking on 3 different subjects. The first subject, which Professor Burbano has already mentioned, is the language of contention, and I will talk about it today. The second is the subject of the book I'm currently working on the subject of war and social movements, an interdisciplinary attempt to look at the relationships between domestic contention and international war. And then the third talk will be something completely new for me, in which I will attempt to expose my ignorance about Latin America by comparing the contentious responses of Europeans and Latin Americans to different economic crises. And this is a subject I hope to work on in the future because, as you can tell, I'm still very young and I have many, many subjects to work on before I'm finished. So let me begin with the concept of the repertoire of contention. And will someone tell me how to turn the... Is it this? No? Is it this?
No, this one.
This one. I want to go back to the beginning. No.
Necesitamos un técnico.
We need a técnico. Okay. I think, yeah, that's it. Okay. Good. Thank you very much. So I begin with a key concept in the teaching of Charles Tilly, the concept of the repertoire of contention. And this concept has 2 dimensions. The first is very obvious. It's what people do when they engage in contentious politics. But there's a second dimension, which is equally important, And it's what people know how to do. It's the habitual, expected, legitimized forms of contentious politics. And in history, there are remarkably few innovations in what people know how to do and what is accepted in contentious politics. And so as we study the historical development of contention, we can study it through the changes in the repertoire, not only in what people do, but in what they know how to do. And the repertoire has three different kinds of sources. The first is the past practice of contention in a particular society. The second is the forms that others have used successfully. And the third are the forms that are legitimated by the state, by the court system, and by movement organizations. Did that go? Now, each of these three sources has an intimate connection to the language of contention. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. The past practice is handed down through the language of contention. Protesters learn about the forms that others have successfully used by hearing about them, by reading about them, and most recently, through social media. And finally, the language of contention is deeply affected by the language that is accepted by the courts, by the government, and by social movement organizations. For example, the term for strike in French, la grève, was only accepted as legitimate by the French state in the late 19th century. Strikes were going on from the beginning of industrialization, but because the French state associated the word grève with working class power, they refused to accept the use of the word until working class organizations forced it upon them. So there are three main points I would like to make in this talk about the language of contention. The first is that this is a language that is polysemic. That is, its meanings change with the historical period and with the context in which the term is used. Think of the word terrorism. It began with the French Revolution, but it was not a word associated with the actions of non-state actors. It was associated with the actions of the state. Robespierre regarded terror and virtue as the main cardinal points of his government. Terrorism was state action. And it was only as the practice of organized violence moved further eastward and southward to Russia and Italy that the term changed its valence from state terror to terrorism against the state. As the political context changed, the meaning of terrorism changed with it. And that's my first point. The language of contention is polysemic. My second point is that the language of contention changes according to the structural context: state building, industrialization, economic crisis. But it also responds to changes in political opportunities and constraints, as we will see with the language of citizenship during and after the transition in Latin America. Finally, I will argue that the language of contention both unifies and divides, such as the difference between individual and collective citizenship, that I'll talk about in Latin America towards the end of my talk. Let me begin, however, with three apologies. First, the words I'm going to examine will mainly be words in English, although I'll make an attempt to look at the diffusion of contentious language into other languages. Second, I will not be able to speak in depth about any particular form of contention. And third, I won't be able to talk about the interesting cover of my book, which I hope some of you will purchase and even read. You may be interested, if you look carefully, and I'm not sure you can see this, that the couple who are celebrating their marriage are carrying a banner which says, in English, just married. You might have thought that this same-sex marriage was taking place in an English-speaking country. But if you look more carefully, no, you can't quite see it, the signs in the background are all in French. Because this same-sex marriage was taking place in Lyon, in France. Yet the concept of same-sex marriage had traveled so rapidly that when a French couple decided to marry, they wanted to advertise it in English. And this is something special, given the way the French feel about language, and particularly about their own language. Now, the first point I'm going to make is that contentious language is sometimes born out of accidents, historical accidents, and then it takes on a meaning of its own. Consider the boycott, which means to refuse to have dealings with a person, an organization, or a group, or to refuse to buy a product as a protest or a means of coercion to boycott foreign produce. The word boycott, we all know today, it comes accidentally into the language because it was the name of a land agent called Charles Boycott in 19th century Ireland who refused to lower the rent of his tenants. And the tenants and the people in the town responded by refusing to speak to him or have any dealings with him. And from that time on, this practice of non-cooperation came to be called the boycott. And the term rapidly diffused and became nearly universal. England, the United States at first, of course, then Holland, France, Germany, Italy, Sweden, and Spain all accepted versions of the term boycott because with the practice of the boycott came the language that signified it, and it helped people to communicate about the forms of contention they wished to use. Recently, by the way, there's been a variation in the term boycott. In English, buycott. B-U-Y-C-O-T-T. And the meaning of that is groups which agree to purchase a particular product because that product is green. Rather than boycotting products that they don't want to use, they will purchase a product that they consider politically acceptable. The same accidental beginnings we can see in the Spanish language in the word for rompehuelgas, and I apologize for misspelling rompehuelgas. In Catalan, the word for strikebreaker is l'esquirol. Now, how does it happen that somebody who breaks a strike is called a squirrel? It has nothing to do with squirrels. It had to do with the fact that strike breakers came from an area called L'Esquirol in Catalonia, from a town called Santa Maria del Corcó, who substituted for the workers who were on strike in a factory in 1852. And from that point on, the word esquirol began to serve as the general term for strike breaker in Spain. Did I go too far? Now, some contentious words don't survive from the cycles of protest that produced them. Here's an example from my own country. In the 1960s, there was a radical feminist movement, and many of these feminists began their political activism in groups of the New Left, in which men were the leaders and regarded women as not very important and not very useful. I could say more, but I do not want to. The term male chauvinist pig was invented by feminists to describe men who refused to give women an equal role in their movements. It came from the radical phase of the U.S. feminist movement. But the term disappeared as the feminist movement became more institutionalized, and it became more important to form coalitions with progressive groups on the left, men and women, than to oppose male chauvinism. And so the term disappeared as a term of political discourse, but it survived in popular culture to mean an extreme form of a term you know well, machismo. This table, this figure, comes from the Engram reader of Google Books in English between 1960 and 2008. It surveys the use of the terms male chauvinist and male chauvinist pig in books in English between those years. And as you can see, the term rises in its use very rapidly in the early 1970s, and then it gradually declines, and it virtually disappears as a term of political discourse. So some contentious words do not survive the cycles of protest that produce them. But others become generalized and widely diffused. Here's an example that has been studied in detail by my colleague and friend, Connie Rogaband. Sexual harassment is a term that was invented by an American law professor, Catherine McKinnon, and it was accepted by the American Agency for Equal Employment Opportunity, and then it spread to Europe in different forms, most of which in one way or another relate to the American term sexual harassment. That has become a cardinal point of American law, and by virtue of the actions of the European Commission, it has become an important point in European law as well, and has been legitimated by the European Court of Justice. So we have to ask, what is it that makes some words for contentious politics survive while other words disappear? And my work has uncovered two main mechanisms. The first I call symbolic resonance, and it's the resonance of a new term with culturally familiar symbols or frames. The second concept is strategic modularity, the degree to which a word that emerges in one strategic context can be adapted to others. And my book is based on the intersection of these two concepts to form the familiar sociological device of a four-cell table and a hypothetical typology of what it is which helps particular language to survive, whether the strategic modularity is low or high, or the symbolic resonance is low or high. In the rest of this talk, I'm going to discuss two different terms that have both gained great symbolic resonance over the past two centuries, as well as great strategic modularity. The first is the strike, The classical term for the withdrawal of labor to put pressure on management, and it has come to signify all forms of industrial action. The second is citizen and citizenship, which began its history in ancient Greece and Rome to mean residents of a city, which then came to mean those who defended their city, then those who possessed the rights of citizenship, particularly civil and political rights, and more recently, the term has been applied in some countries to describe collective indigenous rights. So let's begin with the strike, which originally did not have the significance of a withdrawal of industrial labor. In English, it had two basic meanings. First, to strike out at something or someone or to hit something. And the second meaning, which turns out to have been the most important one in the history of industrial conflict, to lower a sail. Strikes diffused across the English working class in the late 18th century. And their first use was in 1768 in the Port of London, when sailors lowered the sails of their ships. They struck the sails so that the ship would not be able to sail. But by the 1770s, the term strike had spread from ships to a general term for industrial action. By 1772, we can read in the Newgate Calendar, quote, "These disgraceful tumults and the timidity of government spread disaffection into all classes of mechanics," that is, workers, "who, thinking the time at hand when they mid accept what wages they pleased, struck their work." By the 1770s, the term to strike had lost its nautical meaning, its maritime meaning, and had come to mean the withdrawal of labor in general. And the term strike diffused across territory, from England to the United States, where we first find it used in 1810, from England to Germany and Sweden, and through Germany to Austria, Hungary, Serbia, and Croatia, where the same term in slightly different linguistic forms comes to mean industrial action by the middle of the 19th century. We see a similar history in the French term grève, which also had an accidental origin. The term grève, for strike, didn't always mean the withdrawal of labor. The meaning of the term, which I think is similar in Spanish, and certainly is similar in Portuguese, meant the gravel on the shore of the Seine River, where provisions arrived by boat and men without work waited on the gravel looking for work. They were called grévistes. But from workers who were looking for work, the term eventually evolved to mean workers who would not work, that is, who removed themselves from work. Faire grève. And once adopted in Paris, the term for striking spread across France and elsewhere. Here's a partial list of the transnational diffusion of the word grève to Romania and Portugal. It missed Spain somehow. And obviously to Turkey. Now, why obviously to Turkey? The first two countries speak Romance languages, so it was logical that the term grève should be transferred to those two countries. But why Turkey? In Turkey, there was a perfectly serviceable Arabic word meaning the withdrawal of labor. Why did people start using the word grève? And I think the answer was because Turkish intellectuals on the left, when they went abroad to study, went to Paris. And when they came home, they wanted the most modern and the most Western term they could find. for the withdrawal of labor, so they adopted the French word. Now, once it was invented, the term strike expanded to mean all forms of industrial action. In a book by Jeremy Brecher, The Great Upheaval of 1877 in the United States, I did a content analysis of the uses of the term strike as we would interpret them today, and this is what I found. In only 15% of the cases, was he actually describing what we would technically call a strike, the withdrawal of labor. In many other cases, he was describing the turnout of the public to participate in strike, marches of strikers, public meetings, occupations, blockades, and attacks. The history of the term strike illustrates one of the main points of my talk. Language of contention is polysemic, and as it diffuses, it changes its meaning. It tends to expand its meanings. And we will see when we turn from the strike to the term citizen and citizenship that that term, too, has expanded. Now, why was the strike so successful? Let's think back to the two mechanisms I listed at the beginning of my talk, symbolic resonance and strategic modularity. The term had symbolic resonance because workers who went on strike could feel themselves to be part of a tradition going back to the historic industrial actions of the past. Strikes also developed a ritual quality, marching, singing, banging pots and pans. And those of you who are in Connie's class will hear more about this when I meet with you tomorrow, when I will talk about the particular Latin American version of banging pots and pans, which gives a ritual quality to the strike. The term strike also retained its aggressive meaning of striking out or hitting, even when strikes became legal and peaceful. Excuse me for a moment. The strike also had strategic modularity. Striking developed a legal structure and an ultimate state acceptance of its legitimacy. It also gave workers the strategic advantage that they could stop production by putting down their tools. And it could spread through the adoption of similar techniques across an entire sector of industry or an entire economy, and even go beyond the working class. For example, the concept of student strikes. Now, when students go on strike, you're not exactly removing your labor. What you're removing is the legitimation of the university system. When I did my research on the protests of the 1960s in Italy, I found a large number of strikes that had very little to do with the removal of labor. For example, the strikes of mental patients in hospitals, the strikes of prostitutes, the strikes in Naples of the young men who sold cigarettes illegally. Now, that really expands the meaning of the strike. And the reason for this is the term strike has gained such symbolic resonance that people will use the term even for forms of action that have nothing to do with labor. Now let me turn to my second concept. It's one that you may not think of as being part of contentious politics. But in fact, it began its history, at least in the global north, as a term of contention. Because before the French and American revolutions, members of the population were not citizens. They were subjects. The original meaning of the term citizen did not have anything to do with politics. It had to do with residence. It meant you were the resident of a city. It also came to mean that you enjoyed rights and duties that came with residence in a city, including the duty of defending that city, which we find in Machiavelli, in his concept of the citizen militia. And with democratization, participation in governance added still a third meaning to citizenship. And that's the meaning of citizenship that we tend to give it today. Citizenship has differentiated meanings. Evelina Danino, the Brazilian political sociologist, writes, "Citizenship is a historical construct, culturally based, that expresses concrete interests and practices not previously defined by any universal essence. Its contents and meanings constitute a response to the dynamic of the conflict and political struggle lived by a particular society at a given historical moment." Let's take a given historical moment, France, during the decade of the French Revolution, where citizenship gains its modern concept, and it also gains the contradictions that we still see in citizenship today. Citizenship in the French Revolution reflected all three of Danino's meanings. It was a product of political struggle in a particular society in a given historical moment. The political struggle was both internal and external, and it gave citizenship to some subjects and not to others. And each new political elite that came to power strove to delegitimize the one before it by removing the rights of citizenship from that group. The good citizen, The good citizen dressed simply, paid taxes, supported the revolution, served in the army, and of course, was a man. There was talk of citizenship for women at the beginning of the revolution because women were crucial actors at the beginning of the revolution. They marched to Versailles to demand bread from the king. But when the delegates to the National Assembly met to write a constitution in August of 1789, what did they call that declaration? It was the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. And women were excluded. Despite the fact that women formed political clubs and engaged in political debates in the course of the revolution, they were denied citizenship throughout. Now, women were not the only ones denied citizenship. Aristocrats could not have citizen rights. Those who avoided paying taxes and opposed the revolution had no citizen rights. And those who avoided military service could have their citizenship rights removed. Because this was a particular historical moment, France was not only engaged in a domestic revolution, it was soon surrounded by enemies on all sides. It was attacked by Austria and Prussia, and eventually by Britain and Russia. And it was in desperate need of a mass army. And this led to an evolution of the term citizen. Citizenship was universal in concept, but it was divisive in implementation. And it was militarized. The good citizen would defend la patrie by joining the levée en masse, the mass conscription, the world's first example of mass conscription. Citizenship became an instrument of mass mobilization. The citizen army tied male citizens to the state and to each other through education, mobility, and more than anything, a sense of belonging to a common community. This is what Rousseau had to say about citizenship in his notes for the Constitution of Poland. As soon as a public service ceases to be the main business of citizens, and they prefer to serve with their pocketbooks rather than their persons, the state is already close to ruin. Citizenship was divisive as well as unifying. The Parisian sans-culottes fought against the provincial Girondins. The good Republican fought against the bad aristocrat. The Parisian Republic fought against the Vendée counter-revolution, and the citizen army fought against the invader. Now, the concept of the citizen has had varying seasons of rise and fall. In recent years in the United States, the original Republican meaning has given way to a nativist meaning. Citizenship means not being an immigrant. In France, there's an even greater narrowing of the term. Les Français de souche meant to exclude all those who are not born in France, even if they're citizens. Where we do find a renaissance of the term citizenship talk is in Latin America since the transition from authoritarianism. And that's what I want to say a little bit about, with apologies, because my knowledge of Latin American politics is very slight. But it was interesting when I first looked up the term citizenship in Latin America, I found this quote from Bolivar, who interestingly returns to Machiavelli, to the Republican concept of the citizen as somebody who will defend the homeland. And he explicitly makes reference to citizenship in Rome, Greece, Venice, Genoa, Switzerland, Holland, and most recently, I think he was writing in 1812, in North America, where he opposes the concept of the citizen army to tropas mercenarias, to mercenary troops, just as Machiavelli had done 350 years earlier. Now, I'm not going to try and survey 200 years of citizenship in Latin American history, except to say that the liberal revolutions of the 19th century gave theoretical citizenship to everyone, but denied it in practice to large minorities or even majorities, especially indigenous people. And my source here is a wonderful article by, I think, an Ecuadorian historian called Liberal Discourse and the Miserable Indian Race, in which he describes the discourse of citizenship in the late 19th century in Carlos de la Torres, Ecuador Reader. But the term citizenship really becomes interesting in Latin America from the time of the beginning of the transition to democracy, when the defeat of authoritarianism brings about a renaissance of the concept of the citizen. According to Dagnino, the term was increasingly adopted since the 1980s and 1990s by popular movements, by excluded sectors, trade unions, and left parties as a central element of their political strategies. As with the strike, did I miss something? As with the strike, as the concept diffuses, it differentiates its meaning. I won't try and read that for you. You can read it yourselves. My horrible Spanish would probably fracture it in any case. But the point is that from a meaning that was connected to the struggle for democracy among social movements in Latin America, the term citizenship begins to expand in its meanings as it diffuses. On the left, for example, civil and political rights begin to gain favor, as Deborah Yashar writes in her survey of Latin American indigenous politics, whereas the left has prioritized material and social rights above all else, it has moderated this stance in the third wave of democracy. In tandem with this moderation, we've seen the left privileging political and civil rights that it once understood in largely instrumental terms. But the term citizenship has not remained the discourse of social movements. It has diffused from social movements to official discourse. The term begins to appear in the declarations of bureaucracies, of parliamentarians, of mayors, and of presidents. In Brazil, the term appears as a modifier for the Constitution. In Chile, it appears as a modifier for the government. And in one country that you know about, it appears as a modifier for the term revolution. And I am certainly not going to try and tell you anything about that that you don't already know. In conclusion, the diffusion of the term citizenship has produced ambiguities in the meanings of citizenship. Danina writes, there is a perverse confluence between the use of citizenship by social movements in order to broaden and deepen democracy and its use as part of a neoliberal market discourse that requires the shrinking of the social responsibilities of the state. So let me conclude by summarizing what I hope I have said, and I hope you will agree, in the last 45 minutes. Citizenship, like the strike, is polysemic. Its meanings changed with the historical period and with the political context in which it was used. It adapts to structural contexts like industrialization and state building, but it responds more directly to political opportunities and constraints, as in post-authoritarian Latin America, in which its meanings expanded from individual rights to collective indigenous rights. And finally, it both unifies and divides. The citizenship of the post-authoritarian social movements is not the same as the citizen constitution or the citizen revolution. Thank you very much.
Al profesor Sidney Tarrow, quien desarrolló la conferencia Workers and Citizens, Explorations in the Language of Contention. Aprovechamos la oportunidad para indicarles que usted puede descargar las otras conferencias en inglés del profesor Sidney Tarrow en www.flaxoradio.es. Mi nombre es Carlos Flores, siga usted con la programación de Flaxo Radio.